sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The debt ceiling debacle continues. Markets get back all of what they made on Fed Day. LinkedIn's in hot water. Our guest today is Ambrose Evan Pritchard from The Telegraph. And we're going to be talking about the Merkel Germany win and some things about Apple and lots more on episode number 331 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome and how are you? Andrew Horowitz here. And we're going to be talking about a whole host of things before we get to our guest today, who I haven't talked to in some time on the show. He is a great writer, and he has a great ability to provide all sorts of in-depth analysis, particularly about Europe and economies around the world. So we're going to talk with Ambrose in a little while. But before we do that, I wanted to go over some things that I believe are going to be very interesting coming up. Also, some things that I have noticed and want to get maybe your opinion on. A few of these. Now, we know that the debt ceiling debate and the debacle and this whole competition between the Republicans, the Democrats, the Congress, and the current president, and it's just a mess. If one says they want to do one thing, the other says they don't, and what's happening is that we're going nowhere pretty fast. The new thing that we heard on Friday is that the House passed a bill to defund the Obamacare, blah, 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 but that's not going to pass the Senate. Okay, let's just kind of move forward and talk about what's really happening. What's happening is that it seems that the government is going to run out of money if the debt ceiling isn't increased on October 1st. Now, we've been through this before, haven't we, folks? We're like old veterans of this whole thing, that they're going to be holding this hostage until they can get some kind of movement, and that's the Republicans on the Obamacare that they want to try to repeal. Now, obviously, this is probably one of their last times they have the ability to do something like this, and it's at a critical time in the process. It's just what they want to do is take it up to the final hour and, you know, make everybody's life a miserable affair, because it's the only way they can hopefully get part of or all of their requests accomplished. Now, they're not going to do it. It'd be very difficult to do so. I don't think they're going to get the support they need by any means to do any kind of total removal of the Obamacare that's going into effect slowly but surely. But yet, at the same time, this dysfunction is very negative when it comes to credibility issues as well as market's reaction to these types of things. So what we have to now look at is, what effect is this going to have? Well, probably let's think about why the Fed did what it did last week. Now, I don't know if you were surprised. I was pretty surprised. I thought that from all the information that I was looking at and from what we had projected to the areas of what the price of a bond was, you know, the 10-year, let's say, the yield and the price, now compared to when Bernanke first started talking about the whole taper issue, is a very, very large move. And by maybe taking that into consideration and looking at how much the move was a response to what Bernanke had said and where they are now in terms of the bonds, it was almost a freebie. You would think that Bernanke would be able to say, hey, you know what? What we did was talk about it, it moved it, and now we can start scaling back a little bit because it will, you know, it's expected in the markets, et cetera, by about $5 billion, maybe 10. Now, Goldman Sachs thought there would be a $20 billion taper. Well, they were way off. Anybody that thought there would be a taper was way off, obviously. Now, the thing is, though, that at the same time, and here's the real sticking point that I had with this, is that in the discussion and in the notes, et cetera, was this idea that, well, the Fed has become extremely data dependent, and they will adjust according to the data that's out. So these numbers they originally put on of about 6.5% unemployment and 2% or so inflation, and trying to get to those goals, and then they'll, you know, take out the bond buying and the quantitative easing or whatever they're doing right now, or they may do. Well, now they're really going to a data dependency model where they'll see what happens and maybe shift their goals and their targets if they need be. Now, the problem with that is this, that every single data point that comes out through the various data releases or global uncertainty or political instability and problems around the world, or maybe even issues like we're seeing with the debt ceiling, is going to be factored into the idea that, well, is this data point, when we add it to the other ones, going to create an environment that the Fed will start taking away some of the bond buying? So every single data point that you're going to see is going to be market moving because they've designed it that way. Whether they intentionally did that or not, it's going to be. You're going to see markets moving. It doesn't have to move, you know, 1% or 2%, but you're going to see markets moving on the bet of stimulus being withdrawn or kept. And it's also going to get a much greater intensity the closer we get to, let's say, the end of 2014 in particular. Bullard's already calling for a December meeting, probably going to see a taper because it was on the fence and there was a question and it wasn't exactly unanimous. And, you know, at this point, also there's a talk that, who's the next Fed chief going to be? Some people are saying Bernanke should be. Now that we have the knowledge that Summers is out, well, maybe Janet Yellen will be there, and she's rather dovish and looking for all she can to give away as much money as possible, it seems. So now we have to watch, in terms of, I don't mean watch it like every minute, but watch the whole idea and how this unfolds, because really, I think at the end of the day, what happened with Bernanke last week was more of a political situation and worry about, you know, we got the question about Syria that's looming right now. We have the debt ceiling issue that's looming right now. And a couple other things we'll throw in there. The economies around the world and emerging markets probably were a big issue. You know, that's probably what was the overriding issue, not the economy itself. The worry about some of these things starting to affect the economy in the future. Now, we all know how great, or really not so, the Fed has been at projecting their economic views, you know, in terms of where they believe the economies will be sometime in the future. They've been dead wrong. They keep on modifying those because they can't even get close. It's very difficult, by the way, for any economist to try to project what an economy will be 2 years out. Almost impossible. These days, there's so many factors involved that it makes it a very difficult task. So I think we need to really pay attention to what is going to happen and who is going to be the next Fed chief that's going to be put in whenever that happens again, and hopefully it will be soon. And, you know, as we said on the DH Unplugged show this week, seems that Syria is all but history now. No more news, and, you know, it seems that on to the next issue, and maybe it's the hostage situation and crisis that is happening in Africa, or, you know, maybe it's the debt ceiling issue now, but it seems to be an ever-flowing amount of, you know, questionable items and concerns that prop up and then just disappear. There's a variety of other stories I want to talk to you about before we get to our guests. Did you see this whole discussion about LinkedIn? They're accused of hacking customers' emails to get contacts. So what happened is that LinkedIn, it seems that they look through the various email accounts of their customers, and it seems used some of the contact information to promote their site. There's hundreds of complaints that came in, and they're now being sued. And this is really a black eye on the whole idea of privacy, if there really is any privacy these days on the web. And, you know, you have to question how much data that you put out there, and just simply using contacts, emails. In other words, your particular email account that you have. So you think about, now I start thinking about, you know, Gmail or Hotmail and all the names and contacts you have in there and anything that's cloud related. You know, how do we actually as users protect ourselves from any kind of usage of that data by the particular provider? That's a real interesting thought if you think about it. You know, we have various technology like an iPhone or an Android, you know, that it says, hey, it's requesting that you allow X application to utilize, let's say, your location services or your contacts or your email, whatever it is. Think about that for a second. If somehow that gets hacked, well, isn't that going to be a problem? Because what if the hacker is the actual provider or the app developer? That's a real problem. That's pretty scary, I think, in terms of the privacy issue. We'll see what happens with LinkedIn. Take a look at that when it opens up next week and how it's going to actually play out. A couple other things I want to get to. I want to talk about Apple, by the way. We'll talk about that in a couple of seconds here. The Baltic Dry Index, if you've looked at that lately, it's quite incredible. This is the index that tracks, there's a few of them out there. There's the Capsize Index, and there's the Baltic, and there's a variety of them. There's Panamaxes, Supermaxes, the Handy Sizes, all of this. And what it is the price of commodity shipping costs, or the shipping costs for various commodities and dry goods, and there's a dry bulk index. And if you look at this, it's pretty amazing. They have been rising dramatically over the last, month or so. As a matter of fact, the Baltic Dry Index closed its highest level since December of 2011. A lot of this was kicked off after we saw that China's economy was looking a little bit better, that we saw some of the numbers coming in from the manufacturing and the industrial production numbers that were a little bit better. What's really fascinating is if you look at the stocks, the dry shippers and the dry bulk shippers that really were in bad shape, they have come back recently. They're not back to their highs, but they've come back dramatically. You know, you've seen something like, 30 days where you've had about 20 or so of those days, the indices were up. Pretty amazing. Seems like they were either oversold to a level that they were looking for a global meltdown again, or, you know, there's all of a sudden a big move to utilize these, and that's what's happening. So it's either a supply-demand issue or just a natural process of reversion to the mean at this point. A couple other things we'll talk about. Now, first of all, we saw that BlackBerry is going to cut about 4,500 jobs. Sales totally plunged on Friday. They came out with an announcement that is showing that their current revenue stream is just absolutely awful. They're going to take a write-down of almost $1 billion for the second quarter, and it seems that they have sales were about only $1.6 billion compared with about $3 billion, which was the average analyst estimate, which is pretty amazing. And really, this is, as being said by a lot of people, the nail in the coffin for BlackBerry. And you have to wonder who may hopefully buy them at this point moving forward. At the same time, we saw another story come out that was about JCPenney. And JCPenney came out and said that they need to borrow about $3 billion. They've had borrowed about $3 billion this year. And now they're looking to raise some more cash. They said they don't need it for immediate needs, which whatever that means, but they're working with Goldman. And so, you know, we have these situations that we're finding that the really strong companies, the great companies that are out there that have really managed to do well with the balance sheets and their cost structures and have really been attracting a lot of consumers into their retail establishments have done really well. But then you have the others that maybe have not kept up with technology or have not been able to really do a good job at marketing or whatever it may be. They are the opposite end of the spectrum and getting just killed. You know, the question is, JCPenney, BlackBerry, are these going to be names that we remember sometime in the future? I remember, you know, EJ Corvettes and Alexander's and a few other names that aren't around anymore. Well, these two companies are going to be, you know, in that kind of situation. Now, another company you thought would be questionable was Take-Two Interactive. You know, they have the, they're all into gaming. And the big question of the day was, or the year was, is iPads and tablets and mobile devices going to just totally take out the mobile gaming market, or the gaming market as we saw in the past, you know, between Xbox and PlayStation, et cetera. But yet now we find that the Grand Theft Auto just blows away the past record with $1 billion of sales in 3 days. 3 days. Amazing. And what's really nice to see is that the gaming market is still there, because there are a lot of markets right now that you have to wonder what their future is. For example, what about the camera market? You know, I don't know what you're doing, but I use my mobile device pretty much for a camera these days. The pictures are terrific, and it's very convenient, easy to email and send and geotag and store. Now, people say, well, I want to print it. Well, I don't print pictures anymore. The use of pictures for vacations and family. I mean, basically, if I want to print a picture, I'll get a professional photographer. I'll go to them and deal with it that way. But for your average user, especially this next generation, I don't know what's going to happen with traditional cameras unless you are an enthusiast or, you know, a professional. Especially if you get 25, 30, or 40 megapixel camera on your device. That's a whole different discussion. And, you know, talking about that, we'll mention that, you know, Apple obviously came out with their new, not only the new OS on Friday, but they also had the first round of sales of the new iPhone. Now, they have the iPhone 5S, which is a newer model, a faster chip. It has some much better camera, a lot more features. It has a new fingerprint, the ability to use your fingerprint to unlock. So that's the first of its kind in that area for mobile devices and for Apple, and pretty exciting. We'll talk about that, though. There's a problem. And then they have the 5C, which is really just a refresh or a redo of the 5. They changed the camera a little bit, and they put on a color back. Now, one of the things I noticed about the colors, if you look at those, they're kind of pastels. They're not really masculine. And I wonder how many gents are going to be buying the 5C. I'll also share with you that I happened upon an Apple store. It was about, I went to the Apple store, which is not too far from me, at about, I would say about 9:45, 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. And just to see what was going on, there was nobody there. I tweeted a picture of this. There was really nobody in line. They had the line that they were trying to provide a basic organization where they had the line stands that were up and ready to go, so you can queue in there and move around, et cetera, like you would at a, you know, any security post at an airport or whatever. There was nobody, I mean nobody, in that line. And the only people I saw outside were people in blue shirts, which is the Apple folk, the people that work there. What is going on? I said. So I went over and I said, listen, what's the deal? He said, listen, we opened at 8 o'clock and we sold out. We didn't get that many. Okay. There was a line of about 10 people for the 5C. Not a lot of people in the store testing it, though, which you usually have, because people go in after it, even if it's sold out, they want to see what's going on with the phone. And there wasn't a lot of people there. And I was amazed. Meanwhile, we're finding that there was some big sales that are being reported. Now, one of the big issues that you did have was that either by design or by circumstance, there is a tight supply of the iPhone 5S. Now, maybe Apple was concerned about having excess supply and said, you know what, we're only going to ship this much. We only have this much available, to make it much more exciting. You know, it's something that companies do. They kind of restrain the amount of the inventory that they have, and this way it makes it look like it's a lot better, it's a hot item, etc. Now, a couple of things I'll tell you. The 5S had availability into the afternoon. My son, who he actually broke his 4 some time ago and he was using an old 3, he went to the Apple store in the afternoon, actually the AT&T store in the afternoon, and just picked one up real quickly, and there was no problem with it. So I'm really curious to see what the real numbers are going to be when we find out next week. A couple of things I will share with you, though, is that in terms of the OS, I don't know if you have experience with this, basically the design, the new icons and all the things that go along with it, they're nice. It's interesting. It's a change of pace. I really think there's going to be a problem, though, for anybody that has any kind of a disorder in terms of seeing. Maybe they can't see, maybe colorblind, or they can't see between a particular range and contrast. It's very light colors, light color design. It's some of the things are smaller, maybe because it was built for the larger iPhone 5 series when I have the 4. So maybe I need a little bit more length, but the Safari is kind of small and your fingers get caught up a little bit now. And on top of that, the only feature, I mean, like there's a flashlight that's embedded in it now instead of having to have an app. Okay, great. But aside from that, and a couple of the features that I find interesting, I was hoping maybe that they would put out another color theme so that I can have a little more contrast myself. And even a switch back to the old theme if you wanted to go there, because really this looks like more of a change of theme than anything else to me. But I don't know what your opinion is. Not that exciting in my opinion. I mean, you know, you have to get used to a few things. Okay, that's great, but I'm really dealing with, I want the functionality. That's all I'm interested in. Now, the next thing I'll mention about the Apple is that already there have been reports that, I believe it was in Germany, there was a hack and they can already break the code. I mean, it was a day after. Break the code of the fingerprint reader using a fake fingerprint or however they're doing it. Fake finger or something like that. That is a pretty quick crack of this already. And that's a real problem, because if we're talking about cracking a fingerprint, which is supposed to be unique, right? It's supposed to be unique to somebody. And already this is cracked and people are using that as the protection rather than a number. Well, that just kind of took a lot of the spin out of how great this fingerprint reader deal is and one of the major component advances that they have inside of this new iPhone. Now, obviously, we do know that Apple has not been having the best time in the market ever since they announced this new OS and the design of the 5. I think the 5C is actually a little bit too pricey for what it is. But the bottom line is that we have a little bit of concern now about really if this leaves a little bit of a doorway open for, you know, others, because I don't really see the benefit of the major benefit of upgrading right now, unless there was a speed issue. And the 4 and the 5 series, the old 5 series, was perfectly fine. So unless there's a new market that they're opening right now, I do believe that they're going to struggle. I do hope they'd come out with some new products on the Apple TV and a new line of possibly laptops, et cetera, that just don't have to be thin. I'm talking about something that's, you know, again, revolutionary that would be of interest. The watch, okay, we'll see. But bottom line is that this does open the doorway to people looking at other devices at this point and looking at Android and possibly even Windows for an option. So got to keep an eye out on that. The other thing I'll mention is that we're going to be watching the emerging markets this week after they had a really nice bounce when we did see that not only the Fed decided not to taper, but, you know, an oversold situation. Now, on Thursday evening, the key reversal indicator that we have flashed a 5. We haven't seen that in some time. And as a matter of fact, we're getting what's called a cluster. So that happened on Friday, and you saw that on, Thursday evening at the close of the markets, and on Friday the market sold off. Now, did it sell off enough? We saw the KR indicator go down to a 3, which is still not at an equilibrium point, but it did take off some of the froth that we'd see that was built up. I'll mention also that the KRI indicator is it has been built, and it will be available also on the TradeStation platform shortly. I know a lot of people that asked for that. And if you have TradeStation, this is going to be something where you can really find out the reversal points and use this for a contra trade. And it works pretty well in terms of really understanding where the markets are either overheated or oversold. And I'll also mention, by the way, there are two webinars this week that you may want to attend. One is that we're doing on one of the indicators, the radar for TradeStation. And even if you don't use TradeStation, you probably want to attend that. So you just go over to Trigger Charts and you can register for that. It's going to be at, in the afternoon after the close on the 24th. On the 25th, actually, we are the guest of TradeStation. TradeStation is putting on a showcase of all the different Trigger Charts indicators that we have that are available on their platform. So I hope that whether or not you have TradeStation, check that out, because we're going to be showing all the different tools and how it works and where to find these fast zones and these breakout levels. And, you know, particularly right now where things have been a little weird, and frankly, we need to lean a little bit more towards the technicals right now versus the fundamentals, because the fundamentals are not giving us a lot of information. Because if we just rely on fundamentals, we really have many stocks that are way overpriced. So we have to be very careful with that, because things can run in any direction. And oftentimes you do find that something does run in a direction that it has some steam and some inertia. And it could be that you get, you know, a significant overvaluation of a stock here or there. And with that, you want to make sure that you're looking at the technicals, because you'll find those support levels, breakout points again. And this is something that we've actually talked about with our clients, because we've had some real last couple of weeks have not been great when it comes to long short at all. But you have to make some corrections, you have to make some adjustments, and you know that's the part of investing. So, with that, I will also mention that we have a stock that we're looking at right now that I want to share with you. We'll put this up probably Monday, our final research on this. I want you to look at a stock called HomeAway. AWAY is the symbol. Now, I actually personally use this for a rental property that we have. But one of the things that has been recently, and maybe not totally recently, but it's been in the news a bit, has been some fraud where people are saying they have this rental property available. They put the listing up and they collect deposits from people, and they never really own the house. In other words, they just put up a fake house, or they put up someone else's house, or they hack the email of somebody. There's a lot of different schemes that are going on. And what happens is that there's people that are getting defrauded, because basically they trust that these sites, whether it's any of the sites that they have domestically or internationally, are, you know, they're vetted. What we found out is that there is no process that the company has, as far as we could see, for actually looking at and finding out if the property is legit and whether or not the person that put the listing up is in fact the owner. That's a problem. Now, they give you all sorts of tips. They say, hey, make sure you talk to the owner, make sure you call them before you go into this vacation house, and make sure that you know who you're talking to, and maybe use this service versus that service. But a lot of people ask for checks, and they take the check, they cash it, and then that's it. It's all over. So this is something that could really affect this stock, because if there is a question in right now with the whole issue of privacy and potential of any kind of fraudulent transactions that are coming out, you know, we've seen a lot of privacy issues that have come out lately, and the one we just talked about with LinkedIn, well, AWAY could be really seeing some kind of pressure, because basically people will be very concerned about utilizing them from the renting side. So there's a lot more we have. There's a lot more about their earnings and their trajectory and all that. We'll put that up on Monday. But this stock is looking like it could be an issue. But we'll leave that to the next couple of days when you see it on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. With us is Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, and he is the international economics editor for the London Telegraph. He hasn't been on for some time, and I thought it would be great to get his view from an international perspective. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks.
So there's a lot going on in the international area. A lot of times in the U.S., we focus on what's happening here, but you cover the big picture and some of the things that have been happening, obviously, in Europe and in Asia, et cetera. I know you just had a recent trip to Japan as well. So what's kind of your view of what's happening with all the central bank movements and maneuvers?
Well, I mean, at the moment, everything's kind of hostage to the Fed. Because if you really do have a kind of tightening cycle lasting several years in America, that's just going to throw the whole global system out of joint. We're already seeing the first signs of this in the emerging market. Just the sheer hint of that the Fed will start draining dollar liquidity just sent large parts of the sort of emerging market universe into a tailspin, as we saw all those countries with current account deficits have suddenly kind of been exposed, and this has been mass capital flight. But it's hardly begun, because the thing to bear in mind is that there have been roughly $4 trillion of investment in emerging markets, foreign funds flowing into there up until 2008, 2009, the Lehman crisis. And that went into real investment and real activity. And then there's been another $4 trillion that went in the last 4 years, basically. And a lot of that was speculative. And it was, low quality investment. It's very fickle. It's going to come out fast.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a tiny bit of it. But we've seen nothing compared to what could happen if you get some serious capital flight. And they've got more reserves now than they used to have. It's not like, it's not like the Latin American crisis in the early 80s or the Asian crisis in the 90s, when they had pretty small reserves, and they'd also fixed their currencies to the dollar, so they got hit twice. This time it's different. They've got large reserves, but they can't actually use them, because they're owned for all kinds of complicated reasons. To use them, of course, acts as an internal monetary tightening. That's the mechanism. We start selling reserves. It's the opposite of what they were doing before, which is when they were accumulating reserves and buying all these U.S. foreign bonds and basically holding down their currency. That was effectively causing internal overheating and bubbles in their own countries. They go into do the opposite now. They drain it away, and it's like tightening. So they're tightening into a downward cycle, so they can't actually do it. This is why Brazil is desperately trying to do it through the derivatives markets. They've done about $50 billion of intervention to defend the currency through the derivatives market, trying to pretend, kind of disguise it. Well, okay, and that could build up to $100 billion, and you start getting the real money. They're desperately trying not to do what they have to do, which is actually really defend the currency by really intervening seriously. And there's another point here that if they start selling all these U.S. treasuries to defend their currencies, they're driving up the U.S. treasury yields.
Yep.
So one of the causes why we've had this sort of 120, 130 point jump in the 10-year U.S. treasury, which is the global price of money, is that all these countries have been selling their treasuries to prop up their own currencies. So you had a negative feedback loop. It was kind of a vicious cycle. It was getting worse and worse and worse. That pushed up the U.S. treasury yield even higher. Then they got even more crisis. They then had to intervene yet further. You could see this was turning really, really nasty. And I watched Ben Bernanke's press conference after the FOMC meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked about emerging markets. I think they were quite seriously spooked by what happened, and they didn't anticipate it. It kind of blindsided them, and suddenly they realized, my God, this is getting out of control. This is going to come back and bite us. And I think it's a key reason why they recoiled and held off on tapering, even though they knew this would be a huge shock to markets, it would damage their credibility. They decided it was just too dangerous.
Now, one of the things,
quite apart from what was doing internally in the United States, the mortgage market was being hit. There were concerns that was just going to roll over again.
Now, what's interesting is that if you take this to its conclusion of, okay, well, the U.S. has monetary policy that's in, and basically the Fed is pushing money into various fixed income assets, mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. And, everybody's reliant on this. And, obviously the big issue is, I don't want to say a competition, but, with Japan, by doing so, pushes down our dollar, the yen moves up, that's not good for them. So they're going to try hard to move down their currency. Where is the possible exit from this? And I'll just say one other thing. Just the sheer mention of possibly taking a small amount of the bond purchases out is what really started a tailspin in the emerging markets and problems around the world. And how is this? How is it possible that they could ever get out of this?
Well, I mean, one way to look at QE, everywhere, is you're kind of raising nominal GDP growth. I know that sounds very technical, but that means, you're expanding the economic base on which the debt sits. So you're making sure the economy, the nominal base of the economy, is growing faster than the debt, and then you whittle away the debt through this kind of, legerdemain. The opposite of it is a deflationary effect, what they're doing in Europe, where you let the nominal GDP contract in some of these countries like Italy and Spain, and then the debt trajectory just goes through the roof. They go straight towards insolvency and bankruptcy. and that's the track they've been on. So, yeah, okay, you can say, well, if you gradually restore the debt back onto a viable track by doing this, you're actually kind of solving the problem, because what matters is the ratio of debt, the burden of it in relation to the size of the economy. That's what matters. It doesn't matter what the absolute amount is. Then actually one of the secret game behind QE is to devalue the debt, make it less of a burden by expanding the nominal base, whittling it away through a little bit of creeping inflation, trying to keep that under control, but you're basically eroding it through this covert means. That's the game. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, but everybody's doing it at the same time. Does it really happen?
Well, that's fine. They all drive down its currencies against each other. The currency effect is a wash. But you know that doesn't matter, because that's the secondary effect. What you're really trying to do is prevent what's known in economics as the denominator effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's when the debt load is increasing faster than the base of the economy that supports it, and that'll kill you.
Right.
And that's what's been happening in Europe.
Which is also what happened in Japan.
And it's what happened in Japan. Mm-hmm. And the problem in Japan, my view, and it's probably not your view, but you know, they did completely the wrong thing in the 90s. I mean, leaving aside, you know, they had a fossilized structure which they didn't reform and all of that as well. But they went in for these massive Keynesian fiscal packages of massive spending on everything. Huge deficits, building bridges to nowhere, all the famous, you know, essentially wasted. And they pushed up the debt to 245% of GDP. By the end of it all, that's where they now are, public debt. What they should have done in the 90s is radical monetary stimulus, not these Keynesian expansion spending things. That would have whittled away the debt. They would now have a debt ratio less than 100% if they'd done that.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a mess of it. That was all. It's all because of the mix of policy. You know, do you go for Keynesian fiscal policy on the one hand, or do you go for monetary stimulus on the other hand? And they have completely different effects. And I know people sometimes just conflate the two and think it's all the same, but it's not. It's completely different. They're polar opposites. And what QE, the game of QE is to go for the monetary stimulus, take the burden off the fiscal side. And what Europe's doing, of course, the opposite. They're putting all the burden on the fiscal side, and they're going to end up in a mess, in my view. I mean, the disaster that's going to come out of this is going to be Europe, I think, still. I mean, of all the countries involved in this game, they've got the worst policy mix. In the end, it'll come back and bite them. You know, it already has done huge damage. If you look at the chart of the economy in America and in Europe since 2008, the growth, economic growth, real economic growth, they've gone in completely opposite directions. So has the unemployment levels. That is because they had the same shock, basically. The global credit bubble burst. The credit excesses in America and in Europe were roughly comparable in 2008. It was a different composition. It was all the subprime property bubble, etc. In America and Europe, it was this sort of sovereign Club Med Southern Europe bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But it was comparable in scale. They got hit by this shock. They responded differently. You know, production in America is maybe what roughly 4 or 5% above its peak, peak now already.
Yep.
In Europe, it's about 4% below. So you've got a massive divergence. Europe's unemployment is at record level, all-time high. And of course, you know, in the mid high 20s in some of the southern European countries. And in America, it's come right down to 7.3%. It's not great. I know that doesn't tell the whole story. We've got all these other problems, people drifting out of the labor market, the participation rates collapsing, all of that stuff. So it's not a good story in America either. It was a hell of a lot better than what's happened in Europe.
Yeah. Now, to go
into this a bit deeper, into your question, how do they end it? How do they get out of this? Well, I'm pretty sure I know how they're going to get out of it, and it's, nobody wants to admit it. And I've had discussions with people, you know, at a reasonably high level, who sort of kind of talk about this privately, and then they look around their shoulder and hope nobody's listening. I had that conversation specifically with somebody very influential, and they're never going to sell these bonds.
Mm-hmm.
They will quietly just stop paying interest on them, which is already happening in Britain, in fact, Bank of England's holdings. Then they will quietly change the maturities on the bonds, so they're no longer 10-year bonds. They're sort of permanent, you know, zero coupon bonds into perpetuity until you know, kingdom come. And then one day they'll just take them out into a bonfire and, you know, and set fire to them and forget about them, you know, and then just say, well, they never existed. It's just an electronic transfer, boom, it's gone. Flick of a switch.
Does that mean that we can never have a financial crisis again?
Well, what it means is, the reason why you don't, that's called monetizing the deficit,
mm-hmm.
monetizing the debt. And that's a taboo in central banking. And, of course, every hyperinflation in history, that's how it began. They started monetizing the deficit. And the central banks were recruited as an arm of the government to cover the debt, usually in wartime. You know, governments are running huge deficits, so they just got the central bank to start printing the money to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's classic. That's happened so many times around the world. I mean, the history book's full of it. And, of course, it's what happened in Germany in the early 20s. It was a consequence of the First World War. They were living, you know, they ran up huge debts, and then they got, you know. So the Reichsbank simply became an arm of the government. They would just printed money just to cover the government bills every month.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in a deflationary situation, that Japan's been in, it's completely the opposite. You know, and actually you want to be generating some inflation to get out of the hole.
Sure.
And so the point is, you know, in the case of Britain, say, Britain, they bought £375 billion. That's roughly, it's about 27% of the entire public debt
mm.
of Britain, sovereign mm-hmm. debt, has been mm-hmm. built by the Bank of England. The Fed's done the same thing in America, a bit less. Maybe 18-19%, I don't know what. Japan's going to take it even higher. Japan's, what it's doing right now is so mega, by the end of next year, it'll just be a colossal, probably half.
Mm.
I don't know. No, so not half the debt, but that's an exaggeration. It'll be even larger than what the Bank of England's done. So, and if you, at the end of this, you're sitting on these bonds, you've got no inflation to speak of, maybe even falling inflation. Well, then the objections to simply monetizing it, just eliminating it, disappear, because what are the objections? The objections are some kind of, it's a religious thing, we shouldn't do it, but it's a victimless crime. I mean, who's the loser from this? The society as a whole. What you do by doing that, in the case of Britain, say, you simply eliminate 27% of the entire public debt of the country, just like that, at a stroke, flick of a switch. It's a huge, huge benefit to society. You don't have that hanging around you anymore. There are no losers because there's nobody on the other side of the trade. It's purely artificial. Mm-hmm. The central bank, you know, they just cancel it. It's just you send a letter from one institution to another down the road and you say, we eliminate it, we forgive it, end of story. And central banks can do that. They can just create the money electronically, so it's just gone. So the only constraint on this is that it's going to create inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And the other constraint might be, well, if you start behaving like this once, you're going to do it again. You're a serial violator. And you know, you can't trust the central bank that behaves that way. Well, yeah. that's certainly a valid and real objection. But at the end of the day, if you can just conjure away a quarter of your entire debt, if America can just bring its public debt down from 100% to 75%, just like that overnight with the flick of a switch, without creating any inflation, I mean, what exactly is the objection? I didn't fully understand what the objection
I just wish companies could do this. Individual companies would be better off if they could do something like this. How great is that? I mean, I want to do it personally.
Yeah, well, we're America's a sovereign state. It can do whatever it wants. It makes up the rules. So you sovereign states can do what they want.
Yeah, no, I agree.
The Fed's working for the nation, working for the people, for the mm-hmm. taxpayers, for the citizens of the country. If the citizens of the country deem that to be in their interest, well, I don't see the objection. Now, if you start doing favors for individual companies, then you get into all kinds of, you know, you're picking losers and winners. But if you're doing it for a country, it's in the general public interest. There's no kind of discrimination in favor of one person or another. You're just saying the whole nation has its debt burden reduced. And, you know, unless somebody can come up with a very good reason why this is a damaging and bad thing to do, what's the objection? I mean, I'm not calling for it. I'm just saying this is where I think it will end up.
Yeah. And by the way, this is
I'm answering your original question. Yeah. This is simply the logic of what's happened.
Yeah, and frankly, my son is studying American history, and one of the things we were talking about is the basic tenets of the Constitution. And one of the tenets is to provide for the welfare
of the people, which is just what you said. You know, it is for the sovereign, for the country. But let's move on from this because we could talk. I just want to talk about Europe for a second. I know we have only limited time here. And there's two things. One of them is that it seems that some of the methodology right now of governments and we'll take out central banks from this for a second. But governments is to do a lot of delaying or at least postponement of things. For example, we've seen that, okay, you have a certain amount of debt target you're supposed to reach by a certain time. And when it comes to that time and you don't reach that level, even though you're not supposed to get additional bailout funds or whatever else was involved in that particular that goal, okay, you get an extra 4 months, you get an extra 6 months. So is that a tactic that is, I guess it's working because, you know, nobody's, it doesn't seem to be a problem, but do you notice that being an issue that has been cropping up?
Well, it's a huge problem, but it's a huge problem politically. I mean, economically, part of the problem in Europe has been that they've been doing too much austerity, and it's been self-defeating. We now know from the IMF, from all their studies on fiscal multipliers and so forth, that you've got these high-debt countries in a crisis without their own currency, out their own central bank, and no offsetting monetary stimulus, and you push them through this extreme austerity, that is going to a complete tailspin. And so the actual debt trajectory, instead of getting the debt trajectory has been accelerating upwards, been getting worse at an accelerating rate, the more austerity they do in some of these countries. So it's completely self-defeating. So we've seen in the last sort of 12 months, the public debt ratio is rising to like sort of 16%, 13%, 12% in some of these southern European countries, 7% in Italy. So it's actually, within a single year. So it's actually not succeeded. So they shouldn't be doing it. Now, the problem is that the whole political contract in Europe is that the European Central Bank will kind of backstop them now. They will prevent them spiraling out of control and going bust. But only if they deliver on the reforms.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole sort of Germany's sort of willingness to go along with the entire game of monetary union at this point is dependent on them being a perception among the German taxpayers and public that these countries are trying and doing their best. And if you start getting a feeling that they're taking advantage of Germany, or they're just stringing Germany along and they're not really getting on with it, and they're just trying to take the money but not do the hard stuff, and if that perception develops in Germany, that could become a crisis. Now, but I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago in Italy, and several people were saying that. I remember Zerlich was saying, the former World Bank chief, was being exactly this point. The whole thing depends on, is Germany going to walk away from this thing because it feels it's being taken advantage of? So this is why the politics of it is so neuralgic. I happen to think the German prescription for this is completely wrong. But really? There's a reality here that they call the shots. And if they get really unhappy and walk away, then the whole thing's going to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue's not gone away. And there are all kinds of things that are going to happen in the next few months. I mean, firstly, I don't buy the line that Europe's really recovering. I think, at best, it's kind of stabilizing, but it's stabilizing at a level of mass unemployment, which is incredibly destructive for democracies and society. And you just can't have unemployment rates of 26-27%, youth unemployment rates of 60% just going on for year after year. It's just intolerable,
right.
And so I did stabilization is not good enough, and it's not. And furthermore, stabilization doesn't stabilize their debt levels, and it's that they're just galloping upwards. So you're on the cusp in several of these countries. Portugal, I'd say, and Italy have come to mind immediately. We are already at or beyond the point of no return on the debt trajectory, and people just don't want to admit it.
Right.
And another year or two without a proper recovery, even if they sort of manage to eke out, growth of 0.5%, which actually they probably won't, but I mean, even if they did, it wouldn't be enough. It wouldn't stop this thing just spinning out. So this crisis hasn't gone away.
Right.
It's just, whether it hits, and then there could be endless political triggers, and it could be the Italian government collapsing, it could be the German Constitutional Court, which still has to rule on whether the Bundesbank can take part in these ECB rescues. If they conclude, and there's been some hints about this, strong hints, I mean, the head of the Bundesbank testified in front of the court that this was illegal. This is a violation of the German basic law, constitutional law. Well, if the German court agrees with this and they say, well, the Bundesbank is forbidden from participating, the whole thing collapses. And then the euro, I mean, who knows what I mean, can you imagine what would happen if suddenly Germany refuses to?
Ugly.
We'd have an extraordinary situation. So, all this is hanging over. There's so many things that can happen. And there's so many countries that are sort of hanging on by their fingernails, and they just sort of, you know, this could erupt at any time again. And I suspect that that's partly what was in the back of the minds of the Fed when they met. And they were worried because the last two great sort of spasms of the Eurozone debt crisis followed a period of Fed tightening.
Right.
After QE1, after QE2, when they began to sort of, they suddenly cut off the spigot of stimulus and they started sort of signaling they were going to be moving to a tightening cycle. And then, that, you know, that just rippled straight through the European debt markets and just set off this, you know. So I think they're quite concerned this could happen again, and they don't feel they're in the clear.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not at all, I don't think the Eurozone currency experiment is a viable political experiment anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just causing so much tension. You've got essentially they're in the wrong currencies, and there's still a 20% competitiveness gap between North and South, and you can't disclose that by forcing deflation and cuts on the South, because the deflation causes their debt dynamics to explode. So it's just not a viable, so it mathematically can't be done.
Right.
So you can't, you just got a complete standoff. You know, Germany's locked in this colossal trade surplus, 7% of GDP, you know, through a kind of a fixed currency system now in Europe, and everybody's trapped. And, you know, when I travel around Southern Europe and I talk to a lot of people, there's incredible bitterness now among the policymakers. They just feel they're locked into this damn thing. They don't know how to get out of it. They think it'd be a total disaster if they leave the euro or forced out of the euro. But they think it's a total disaster if they stay in
it. Right. There's no win. Yeah, I agree. There's neither side, because it depends on which side you're on. I mean, obviously the South is you know, riding the coattails of the North, and the North is aggravated because they have to share their success, if you will, with the South.
Yeah, and I think the German position is completely untenable. I think they're enforcing a kind of gold standard, totally destructive set of policies on Southern Europe. It's repeating all the errors of the interwar years, you know, forcing all the burden of adjustment on the weakest deficit states. So I think it's totally misguided. But I will say this, that the German people have never had it properly explained to them what's going on.
Mm.
They didn't vote for the euro. They didn't want the euro. They wanted to keep the D-mark. They were kind of dragged along into this thing politically by the French and the Italians. They didn't want to do it. And now the whole thing kind of blows up because in their minds, you know, these other countries are not playing by the rules. And so I have a huge sympathy for the German citizens in this, that they're now being asked to sort of bail it out the whole damn time. And they're just sort of completely sick of it.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, we've got this complete, this is the problem with the whole project. It's led to these huge kind of, there's all this sort of bitterness. Everybody's blaming each other. The central problem is structural. It's in the nature of the monetary union itself and the way it was created. There's nobody to blame. It's not because Italians or the Spanish are behaving badly. It's not because the Germans are behaving badly. It's the structure of the thing. It should never have been created. It's unworkable. It's inevitably leading to all these tensions, and these tensions will just carry on and on and on, and they have already turned Europe into quite an unpleasant sort of political place. As we're seeing with this sort of new Greek Nazis and a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, I hear you.
And that's the early days yet, I would say. I mean, I was amazed, and I spoke to the foreign policy chief for this new German party, Eurosceptic Party, AfD. He's very nice. He seems to be talking about secret deals with Russia and giving you giving up Ukraine and saying Poland shouldn't be in NATO, and I mean, really weird stuff. When you begin to wonder, oh my God, are we unleashing something? Have we uncorked something here which we don't really want? This is where it's going. You know, people are furious with the kind of European policy establishment. They're furious with the way they've been dragged into this thing. It's gone way beyond what they ever really wanted. And it's creating this sort of revolt everywhere, these rebellions everywhere, which are quite which have a slightly unpleasant flavor to them in some places, and that could get dangerous.
Yeah, I hear you. Listen, we could be going on for days because there's so many things to talk about. We didn't even touch upon really the core of what is happening in Japan. We'll have to do it again sometime. This is Ambrose Evans Pritchard, or from, of course, the London Telegraph. You can read all of his information, which he writes just eloquently, my friend, over at telegraph.co.uk, and he's the just go to the finance place. We'll put the links directly to all of your articles right on the show notes. And I really want to thank you so much for taking the time.
Totally good. Terrific. Thanks a lot. Bye.
And that's going to wrap it up for this show, this episode. And I want to thank you for joining me. Check out all that we have on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. Make sure you're there for the webinars that we're having this week. You'll learn a lot. I promise you that. And of course, listen in on DH Unplugged. Will be available on Wednesday. We have the closest to the pin competition with prizes. If you guess the price of the stock that we have, we did Apple recently, Boeing, 3M, lots of goodies out there. So please make sure to check it out over at dhunplugged.com. Everybody's invited. And you're also invited to listen on iTunes and wherever else you may like to listen. Thanks for joining me again. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.